Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Joel Neal, and to begin, we discuss key data sets presented at the recent ASCO meeting, beginning with one of the most anticipated phase 3 trials in non-small cell lung cancer, the RADIANT trial, comparing 2 years of erlotinib to placebo as adjuvant treatment in 973 patients testing positive by either FISH or IHC for EGFR. And while the study showed no benefit for erlotinib overall, in a non-previously specified subset of 161 patients with activating EGFR mutations, while there was no overall survival benefit, the progression-free survival increased from 28.5 to 46.4 months with a hazard ratio of 0.6. Dr. Neal began by commenting on the background of this trial.
At the time when RADIANT was developed, it wasn't known that EGFR mutations were the important predictor of response among patients being treated with erlotinib. And so the RADIANT trial was designed to where they took patients positive by EGFR immunohistochemistry protein positivity, which is true of about 95% of lung cancers, and also FISH positivity, probably about a third of lung cancers were positive for that, and either one of those qualified patients to get into the RADIANT trial.
I mean, ultimately, now that we sort of know a lot more about EGFR TKIs, these criteria, do they have anything to do with responsiveness to erlotinib now that we kind of have more information?
Maybe a little bit. So the EGFR amplification by FISH does seem to track somewhat with the presence of EGFR mutations. The immunohistochemistry is just present across many lung cancers, and I don't think is particularly predictive of response to EGFR TKIs.
So they did present the data from the patients who had assays. It wasn't stratified or built into the design or anything like that. But it was kind of provocative. It kind of reminded me a little bit when we saw the one-arm SELECT trial, kind of a hint, but not sure what to do with it. What about that subset?
The subset of patients, there were about 80 patients who had EGFR mutations on the treatment arm and about 40 patients who had EGFR mutations who are on the control arm of untreated. And we did see improvement in two-year disease-free survival amongst the patients with EGFR mutations. This was a randomized trial, the first randomized data that we've seen. Also, the SELECT trial, which was a joint effort between Dr. Sequist and myself as a fellow at Mass General during that time and Nate Pinnell, we presented an update of the full 100-patient SELECT trial and observed on our single-arm trial, a two-year disease-free survival of 89% across multiple stages. Stage 1 was about 50%, stage 2 and 3 about 25% each. But a two-year disease-free survival of 89% is fantastic in lung cancer, regardless of the subset, and we're very consistent with the RADIANT EGFR mutant subgroup analysis.
You said you put patients on SELECT. How was it to try to get somebody through an adjuvant TKI?
Well, just like with metastatic disease, patients have differing responses and tolerability to the agent. But without having disease to see and follow and watch it respond, as is so exciting in stage 4 lung cancer, when patients don't have that positive energy from seeing a great tumor response, it's harder to continue on the trial. I would say there's a lower threshold to dose reduction, because dose reduction is a way to alleviate side effects, particularly the fatigue gets to be intolerable after a year or two. The rash tends to burn out after a month or two or three, and the diarrhea is relatively minimal. So the same spectrum of side effects as we see in stage 4 disease, but it is easier to dose reduce because we don't know what the treatment benefit is.
One thing, given this issue of maybe you're going to need longer-term therapy, is the next generation of EGFR TKIs. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about these agents? And the thing that I've heard that's interesting is, I guess they seem to have a different toxicity profile. They don't hit the wild-type EGFR. I was wondering whether maybe that could work easier in the adjuvant setting. What about these agents?
Right. There's what we consider the second generation EGFR TKIs, both afatinib and dacomitinib. Dacomitinib was the drug that was the evidence from wild type patients without EGFR mutations at ASCO was not overwhelming for dacomitinib. Afatinib is, of course, FDA approved for the first-line treatment of patients with EGFR mutant-positive non-small cell lung cancer. So the first question is whether these agents might be employed in the adjuvant setting. And we have a small follow-on trial to the SELECT trial open at Stanford, as well as Mass General and Memorial Sloan Kettering, which is using adjuvant afatinib. And in that study, based on what we saw in the SELECT study, we didn't know whether there is a benefit to 2 years. Clearly, it's hard to be on for 2 years, and afatinib does have a different toxicity profile from erlotinib. So the design of this trial is, again, about 70 patients, but randomized between 3 months of therapy and 2 years of therapy to try and tease out that question of, is longer actually better if everybody gets some? So afatinib has more mucositis. Mouth sores are one of the big additional complaints that patients have, and more diarrhea in general than erlotinib has. I would say the rash is equal or maybe slightly less, and the fatigue, at least dose equivalent, is probably comparable. In the adjuvant afatinib study, we also addressed the toxicity issue by starting at a dose of 30 milligrams, which is under the 40 milligram recommended starting dose in the stage 4 setting.
As long as you brought that up, I'm curious right now, in what situations, if any, are you using afatinib as opposed to, for example, erlotinib?
So I think afatinib is used in a couple of different settings right now. The primary practice that I've used it for is in patients who have become refractory, had EGFR mutant lung cancer, become refractory to erlotinib, then maybe gotten chemotherapy or other intervening treatment, and patients in whom we would consider restarting their erlotinib would probably have some sort of beneficial effect, a rechallenge. And in those patients, I think it makes sense to increase to afatinib, the increased potency against T790M, although it's in proportion to the wild type potency and in proportion to the EGFR potency, I think it's a different drug and it may have slightly different effects against the cancer. So I'll use it in the acquired resistance setting. Of course, there's the promising data by adding cetuximab, which we've employed sometimes off of clinical trials, which increases the response rates from about 10% with afatinib in acquired resistance to about 50%. And the other setting that I'm intrigued by afatinib with some data from ASCO 2014, in which they presented for the first time that afatinib appears to have an overall survival benefit when given in the first line setting compared with chemotherapy in both the LUX-Lung-3 and the LUX-Lung-6 trials. So these were chemo versus afatinib head-to-head, both a Western study and an Asian study. And in both studies, there was a survival benefit in the retrospective subgroup analysis for patients with exon 19 deletion specifically, but not L858R mutant lung cancer. So I'm wondering if there is something specific about afatinib in binding to exon 19 deletion. And all of these patients, many got crossover to gefitinib or erlotinib. So maybe there is something a little bit better about afatinib for that patient subgroup.
I guess that also gets into the issue, because I know there was a paper at the World Lung Meeting about different kinds of mutations in EGFR. We heard some things about, I think it was exon 20 as an example, but there are others that are much less common that don't necessarily respond to EGFR TKIs, and they were reporting a bunch of data with afatinib. What do we know about these alternative mutations at this point?
Yeah, that's a great question. I did have a chance to review some of that data about the atypical mutations and the effect of afatinib after the World Lung Cancer Meeting. And my conclusion was they didn't give us enough specifics about each one of those mutations and the subsets to know whether it was afatinib behaving differently from erlotinib or whether it was just subsets that erlotinib would have responded to. So the classic subsets, the big ones are T790M de novo or in the acquired resistance setting. We don't expect either erlotinib or afatinib to have proportionally more effects on that subset of patients, because to get effective T790M inhibitory activity, the wild type activity is pretty high too, and it becomes intolerable. Then there's the exon 20 insertion mutations. And these really fall into two different subgroups, which haven't been fully characterized. If they're lumped all together, the ones toward the N-terminus, toward exon 19, the FQEA insertion mutations described by Dan Costa, are really sensitive to erlotinib even. and can be sensitive to afatinib too, whereas most of the ones more toward exon later end of exon 20 and exon 21, those insertion mutations tend to be resistant to both agents. So when I saw at World Lung, the data presented said the median progression-free survival amongst EGFR insertion mutant positive lung cancer was about 4 months, compared to a PFS of what we expect for afatinib being well over a year. So really, it's a heterogeneous group of patients, and I expect those ones sensitive to erlotinib should be sensitive to afatinib too, and I don't know where those subsets fell out.
That also, I think, leads into the issue of testing. And I know you were very much involved with a paper that came out a few months ago in the Archives of Pathology Lab Medicine from, I guess it was a biomarker reporting work group of the College of American Pathologists. It's been really interesting to see this whole thing evolve about how to test non-small cell lung cancer. What did this group determine, and what's the general thinking right now in investigators about how to do this testing and whom?
Yeah, the synoptic report that we put together in collaboration with pathologists really aimed to standardize the reporting methods. So out of all of the testing that was done to put it in the same place and to standardize histologically how lung cancer is reported, as well as on a molecular basis, the academic centers have been testing by all kinds of different methods, and there's a number of reference labs out there that also do molecular analysis. I'd say in the community, the standard remains to test for EGFR in mutations, ALK translocations, and probably ROS1 gene rearrangements or translocations as well, based on the effects of erlotinib for EGFR and crizotinib for both of the latter two. But in practice, especially at the academic centers, we've gone in a multiplex direction, so we can test for more things. Currently at Stanford, we're using the Snapshot gene panel plus the two FISH tests for ALK and ROS1. Snapshot is EGFR, KRAS, BRAF, HER2 insertions, and a variety of other things that are considered less actionable. But I think the direction that things are going is to multiplex on a next generation platform. And then we can analyze 80 genes at the same time, see the rearrangements, and do one test that'll be relatively inexpensive that will cover everything all at once. There's been talk about sequencing, do KRAS first because it's the most common, and then do EGFR, and then do ALK, and then do ROS1. But in my experience, most of the time that uses up the valuable tissue and uses up valuable time also. So multiplex tests are kind of the broad spectrum mutational analysis, I think, will become the standard in the next couple of years.
In terms, though, of community-based practice, I think a lot of general oncologists, when they first started to hear about, I think EGFR mutation was just 10 years ago that it was discovered, so things are happening pretty fast. But I think a lot of oncologists were thinking this is going to flip into sort of a breast cancer ER and HER2 model. Every time you get a piece of tissue, you're going to test it. But, you know, we started out with this whole thing with the smoking and, you know, racial background, et cetera. Right now, in what situations, let's say EGFR, are you testing? Or would you test a heavy smoker with squamous cell, for example?
It's very important to think of your pretest probability whenever we're running any of these tests on tumor tissue. So it's not my practice to test squamous non-small cell lung cancer because our current panel isn't really appropriate to identify potential drivers in squamous. So the heavy smoker with squamous generally gets chemotherapy and maybe consideration of clinical trials down the line, but without molecular analysis. On the other hand, I have an Asian never-smoking woman who also has squamous non-small cell lung cancer who has an EGFR mutation that's absolutely been sensitive to erlotinib for the last 2 years.
I've heard about those kinds of cases, but yeah, it's a little bit interesting to think about. What about non-squamous? Everybody?
Yeah, so we are testing all non-squamous for the common drivers in our panel, and that includes patients who have smoked very heavily. We do find EGFR mutations, even in people who have smoked previously or are active smokers. There was a little bit of data from some of the posters at ASCO that did suggest that the prognosis and the response to erlotinib and TKIs in patients who have smoked with EGFR mutant lung cancer is not quite as good as those who haven't smoked. So I think we don't understand the full story. Still, those tumors are often sensitive to the TKIs, but maybe not for quite as long.
And in terms of ALK and ROS, again, all non-squamous?
We are doing it for all non-squamous, mainly because of the tissue issue, even if it's pretty improbable. We'd rather do it up front than to have the lingering question of what if we'd looked.
But on the other hand, a general oncologist might not have easy access to a multiplex, or there might be reimbursement issues. What would you say to a physician like that?
I think for adenocarcinoma, non-small cell lung cancer, there shouldn't be reimbursement issues for, at the very least, testing EGFR and ALK in all patients. Whether we test for the less common drivers, ROS1, where there's not, as of right now, an FDA-approved therapy, or HER2 insertions, or BRAF mutations, all of which are very sensitive to targeted therapies, but much less common. Perhaps that can be deferred for later into a multiplex panel, or if a patient does well and goes for more testing later on. But I would say EGFR and ALK are well worth testing in all patients with adenocarcinoma.
So I want to ask you about the work that's been done on another new agent that doesn't have a name right now, CO-1686. Maybe we can start out with that. Can you talk about, I don't know if this is considered like third generation EGFR TKI therapy. What is this agent? What other agents are out there? And what do we know about these agents?
We're calling these third generation EGFR inhibitors. And really the reason for that is because afatinib and dacomitinib filled the second generation space. So what we know is that there were three of these drugs presented at ASCO. There was CO-1686, there's AZD-9291, and then there was HM-61713. And these drugs are all in a class that is slightly different from erlotinib and afatinib in that they spare wild-type EGFR. So in theory, have very little rash, very little diarrhea, but are specific against the sensitizing EGFR mutations such as exon 19 deletions and L858R, but additionally bind as tightly or tighter to T790M in context of those other mutations as well. So these drugs are very exciting because they spare some of the toxicity of the EGFR TKIs, but also hit acquired resistance in the form of T790M, the second EGFR mutation, which happens in about half of people with acquired resistance who've been treated with EGFR TKIs. So all of these drugs, I think it's hard to compare, and Tom Lynch did a nice job in his discussion of demonstrating equipoise of all of these are promising, and we don't really know whether one is better than the other. There are certainly different side effects. The CO-1686 is associated with hyperglycemia. The AZD-9291 had some low incidence of interstitial lung disease, which we always worry about with any TKIs. And the HM was presented data at much lower doses, so it has a lower on-paper response rate, but we really haven't seen at the maximal tolerated dose yet. So all of these, in acquired resistance, T790M positive EGFR mutant lung cancer, have response rates over 30%. And in the case of AZD and Clovis, the CO-1686, over almost 60% response rates.
Where do you see things heading? And we were talking about adjuvant therapy. Do you see these agents maybe being more tolerable for longer periods of time, like in the adjuvant setting?
They certainly may be. We have some experience and we've seen the toxicity profiles where they do appear to be more tolerable, at least without the classical EGFR TKI side effects. We always do worry about interstitial lung disease, particularly in the adjuvant setting of curing patients. But I think these are promising, both in the first line setting of treating patients with EGFR mutant lung cancer in advanced disease, but also potentially in the adjuvant setting. Now, the issue with the adjuvant trial, one thing we didn't discuss was that there is a definitive trial planned. It's under the ALKMIST umbrella. It's the ALKMIST trial, and there's both a definitive ALK-positive adjuvant trial as well as an EGFR mutation-positive adjuvant trial planned. Both will have hundreds of patients. Both will be randomized. The current plan is placebo for 2 years versus drug for 2 years. And after randomizing hundreds of patients, we'll have to wait a number of years before we definitively answer this question. And I don't think it's even clear whether our endpoint should be disease-free survival or the gold standard overall survival, and whether we'll see that if these drugs are truly cytostatic. So until we figure that out with the existing TKIs, even simply with erlotinib, which has been in common use for over 10 years, then it's going to be difficult to know how to employ these next generation, second generation, and third generation EGFR TKIs in the adjuvant setting.
So I want you to present your 61-year-old man, but before you do that, one other, I don't know, side issue. I noticed that just in the last couple of days, at least that I saw for the first time, The Lancet Oncology presented the results of the so-called PROS study. I think it was reported at ASCO a year ago, looking at the VeriStrat assay, a proteomic signature. I've always been fascinated by that data, though I'm not sure exactly what it means at this point. Can you talk about what this assay is looking at as it relates to this issue of TKIs and what you think about the data right now that came out of that study and this data related to it?
The PROS study was investigating the role of EGFR TKIs in all patients, not just patients with EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer, but a wider group of patients. And the VeriStrat assay is a mass spec-based serum marker assay in which I believe 8 peaks are generated of relative amounts, the identities of which we don't really know. But it can be profiled from a serum assay of a patient with active cancer into either a poor prognostic group or a good prognostic group. And the PROS study, in a prospective way, was the first study to suggest that those patients with the good overall category on the serum marker, the VeriStrat test, seem to do better with treatment with EGFR TKIs, whereas the poor subset did not do better with EGFR TKIs. Now, the enthusiasm for using erlotinib in the second, third, fourth line setting, I'd say, has diminished considerably from the initial introduction in 2004 overall. And it's still not possible to predict exactly from the tumor tissue who will respond, say, the squamous man who's a smoker, even though the drug is FDA approved for the second and third line indication for that patient. It's hard to tell whether they will actually respond, have stable disease for a few months or longer. And because of that, VeriStrat's trying to tease out whether that drug should be used. My conclusion is that I think erlotinib is still perfectly appropriate in the maybe second line, but maybe third line, fourth line, fifth line setting, probably even regardless of what VeriStrat shows, because the question we have to ask is how many good alternatives do we have? And once a patient's had chemotherapy once or twice or three times and is to fourth-line chemotherapy, I think the TKIs present a reasonable alternative. My personal practice hasn't been to use VeriStrat, although it does seem to be demonstrating something prognostically.
I was just amazed they did a phase 3 study on a biomarker. You don't see that like every day.
That's true. And it's difficult to tease out the prognostic versus predictive effects. And that study does do a nice job of showing it is predictive.
Well, we'll see where that heads. Let's talk about your case that's kind of relates to the scene, which is a 61-year-old man. And sounds like you were dealing with, to me, I think it's the number one question oncologists have about EGFR mutant disease, which is the patient who responds and then progresses. So what happened with this man?
Yeah, so this man's a non-Asian man, never smoker, had EGFR mutant lung cancer diagnosed about a year ago based on bone metastasis, exceedingly functional, avid cyclist. The scan showed a 3-centimeter right upper lobe mass, some mediastinal adenopathy, and a bunch of bilateral pulmonary nodules. So as was standard of care, the mutational testing was done waiting for decision of treatment, and exon 19 EGFR mutation was seen. So he received erlotinib standard dosing, had a good response for about a year, and then had disease progression. So the question is what to do next. And I think there's a number of right answers, and based on ASCO, even increasingly more potentially right answers. So the first is whether the patient should receive chemotherapy. And the answer is absolutely yes. At some point, chemotherapy is quite effective against EGFR mutant lung cancer. And I view it as it stands the ability to reset the cancer and get away from an EGFR-directed therapy, more in a cytotoxic way, which no matter what the mechanism of resistance, it shouldn't be resistant to chemotherapy right away. So platinum doublet or triple chemotherapy is perfectly appropriate in every patient with EGFR mutant lung cancer. The second question is, should the patient receive afatinib at this point? I think we touched on this a little bit a few minutes ago. And the response rates to afatinib right on the heels of erlotinib are probably 10% or less in terms of shrinking the disease. Maybe it will provide disease stability. This patient does have exon 19 deletion EGFR mutant lung cancer, so maybe there's something special about that and afatinib. But afatinib alone probably would have modest response rates and potentially increased toxicity. This patient had a lot of scalp irritation, had to see a dermatologist, ended up being dose reduced to 100 milligrams from 150 milligrams. So afatinib by itself may be toxic in that same way. But afatinib plus cetuximab, even though its increased toxicity is certainly there, shows response rates regardless of T790M or not of about 50%, which is impressive and is increasingly, I believe, probably being used off-label in a variety of settings. I've had patients referred from community oncologists who have tried it or tried to obtain authorization, at least, as an alternative to a third-generation EGFR TKI, which aren't available everywhere. Then the third option, of course, is the third-generation EGFR TKIs. And the ones available in the U.S. right now, as far as I'm aware, at academic centers are the AZD drug and the CO drug. And patients tend to be pretty savvy and aware that these are around, and the academic centers are open and screening patients. But there's a catch, and the catch is it requires a repeat biopsy, and it requires proof of a new EGFR T790M mutation, and those are the patients who seem to have the highest response rates. There may be modest response rates in patients without those, and whether that's an artifact of testing where it was there and missed, or whether the drugs are actually active as any EGFR TKI would be after patients have been previously not treated. Say, this patient we're talking about right now had chemotherapy and then went on to receive a third generation, might have a response rate just because it's another TKI and some period of time has elapsed. But as of right now, I think all three of those things, not even including immunotherapy, which is a whole different spectrum of activity, all three of those options, I think, are perfectly reasonable for this patient.
So what actually happened?
The patient was screened and did have an EGFR T790M mutation and went on to the CO trial.
I was just fascinated that you don't see rash. You've seen a number of patients and they just don't get rash?
Patients do not get rash. In their previous rash, if they were previously, a number of these patients were on erlotinib or afatinib going into the trial, and it gets better while they're on the new drug.
Wow, really amazing.
That's it is
really
amazing. So we saw also some progression-free survival data, though, at ASCO. And the progression-free survival for the CO1686 drug for patients at the highest dose who had T790M-positive tumors was exceptional. Looked like it could be over a year. It hadn't been reached yet.
So in terms of EGFR mutant disease, I wanted to ask you and anyone else I can talk to what you thought about the very provocative paper at ASCO looking at erlotinib alone or with bevacizumab.
The progression-free survival of erlotinib alone was the usual 9.7 months, but with the combination of the two agents, it was 15 months. And there's another similar trial going on in the U.S., and we'll see more data in this realm. But there's a thought that maybe the angiogenic signal from EGFR mutant lung cancer is rather monotone and maybe very VEGF-driven. And in the beta trial, where everybody was mixed in together and the subgroup analysis was done of EGFR mutant patients, they had a very strong progression-free survival benefit too. So maybe those are the patients where they should get bevacizumab, possibly with the erlotinib, or possibly, and we're extrapolating here, whenever they get chemotherapy, whether that's second line, third line, beyond, which would be more in line with standard of care.
What do you think about it as an off-protocol strategy?
Well, Jack West's comment, he did a fabulous job discussing this. He illustrated two things, and he said, one, this is his preferred first-line treatment strategy going forward for EGFR mutant lung cancer patients. However, not sure whether it's going to be paid for. And he showed one bar graph of the cost difference, erlotinib now on the street being $5,000 or $6,000 a month, but bevacizumab being still about $10,000 a month, really almost tripling the cost of care for these patients. So I think that's the biggest downside to the oft-cited approach of let's give it all together. Let's give the carboplatin plus doublet therapy with the bevacizumab and throw in the erlotinib. There was some interesting data out there saying TKI, it was from one of the poster discussions that I had the opportunity to discuss, but it basically said concurrent chemotherapy with carbo and pemetrexed together with gefitinib, was superior to sequentially alternating or oscillating between those two things in every six-week strategies. Kind of two confusing first-line alternatives, but flowed from Tony Mock's FASTACT 2 study of carbogemcitabine plus or minus EGFR TKI. Actually, the overall survivals are unbelievable, adding it all together in the first-line setting. Yeah, 31, 32 months overall survivals, which are great even for a patient with EGFR mutant lung cancer, and said, what we don't want to do is make sure that a patient never receives one or the other. Chemo's good, TKIs are good, but I'm still in the sequencing mode as opposed to the pilot altogether, because I think the cost of care is going up and cost is something we have to factor in. So have I used it? No, but I'm certainly more enthusiastic about bevacizumab, whether it's with the erlotinib or with the chemotherapy. I'm more enthusiastic for the EGFR mutant patients now.
So one last thing I want to ask you about is, I know your group had a paper at the Sydney International meeting about palliative care in lung cancer oncology, and I had the pleasure of interviewing Jennifer Temel from Mass General, who had the big paper with the, you know, randomized trial showing that people live longer with palliative care. I'm curious what you think about this sort of general area and how at Stanford, you, Heather Wakely, and everyone else is kind of thinking through, you know, how to bring this into your practice.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to be a fellow at Mass General under the directorship of Dr. Temel while I was a fellow there, and saw a lot of patients there in collaboration with our palliative care doctors, clearly very strong. And also, our group was joined around the same time that I got to Stanford by Kavitha Ramchandran, who is a palliative care trained and thoracic oncology trained expert, who's really helped us with many of these initiatives at Stanford and bringing palliative care into the integrative setting in our clinic. So we have a palliative care program. They train fellows at Stanford, and that palliative care program has set up clinics within the oncology group that co-mingles together with us in thoracic oncology, as well as GI oncology and many other specialties. So it's an optional referral system, of course, but any patient at any stage in their diagnosis or treatment can be referred for co-management with palliative care. And when that happens, palliative care docs will see them in the infusion room while they're getting infusion, so they don't take extra time in the clinic or feel like it's slowing down their day. They'll see us down in clinic and help with pain management or some of the tougher issues that we wrangle with for patients that it's difficult to control the symptoms of their disease as we're pushing forward with chemotherapy, or help with those transitions toward more end-of-life discussions and goals. What we know is from Dr. Temel's work that there's certainly no survival detriment, and actually in the MGH setting, there was a survival benefit toward early referral to palliative care. And I often cite these data to patients who are usually reluctant to see a palliative care or supportive oncology. Our group at Stanford has gone through a number of different names, is what the optimal balance of names showing hope yet illustrating what they do. So palliative care, supportive care, palliative oncology, supportive oncology, all of these names have been tried. But that group at Stanford really does an excellent job of helping with patients, whether it's early in their disease course or later on in the disease course. And we can support that referral for patients at any time. And patients say, oh, it might help me live longer. I'd be happy to go see them.
Just from a clinical point of view, when patients come back to you after they've seen this palliative specialist, what's your take on how they're benefiting?
The concrete symptom management in terms of pain medicines and how to use the latest pain medications. Certainly there are a few patients who I've learned what their tool set is and tried it myself. On the other hand, if somebody needs methadone for complicated pain, I think it's much more appropriate being given in the palliative care setting. I think the other big role that they play is they're an independent sounding board for patients. And as oncologists, we're holding the keys to the chemotherapy. And sometimes they won't say everything about how they're actually doing at home and how that 2.5 weeks was in between chemotherapy, and minimize the amount of angst that they're having from the treatments that we're giving. So I believe that palliative care can be that independent listening group and then feedback to us and say, is it really the right thing to be pushing forward with treatment as tough as we're giving? Maybe a dose reduction is the right thing to do, and help establish to patients that that will help them. And by doing that, it may actually help them live longer. So I think they help by dealing with symptoms, which is their direct benefit, but also maybe keeping us from giving chemotherapy a little too close to the end of life, which certainly is one of those benchmarks that ASCO looks for, and one that Dr. Temmel's presentation said it happens less often. People are on hospice for a longer time, and sometimes that helps them live longer. I like to describe hospice to my patients as an active treatment now. Just like chemotherapy, just like radiation, it's an active treatment that can be started and stopped, and it's directed against symptoms. And if hospice becomes something that's not relevant for them anymore, we can stop it and we can consider all the other active treatments that are in our tool set. And that helps them grasp a little bit better that hospice is not a one-way street, or me saying it's time to die and go on to palliative care now. But if a time comes when they're feeling so great because we've stopped other treatments, we actually should consider treatment again.